reaction to that in this country. And I think that we have to be willing to challenge those who are saying that somehow a permanent provision of a weapons pipeline is not going to end this war. We have to be very clear of the danger. This war threatens the possibility of a nuclear escalation in a way that no war, no situation since the Cuban Missile Crisis threatened.
Phyllis.
It was not true in Iraq, Afghanistan, or the others. It is a threat here. And for that reason, the global consequences and the regional consequences of militarization and famine and the environmental cost, all of that, the top of that pyramid of costs is the nuclear threat. And that's why we need to end this war as rapidly as possible.
Phyllis, before you go, I want to ask you about Gaza. Overnight, Israel launched surprise airstrikes in Gaza, targeting three commanders of the Islamic Jihad assassinated in their homes. The attacks killed a total of 13 people, including the wives and children of the commanders. The Israeli attack broke a ceasefire that had been reached last week after a spike in violence following the death of the Palestinian prisoner Hada Adnan in Israeli custody, who'd been on hunger strike for 87 days. In this last minute we have, can you comment on what's been happening?
This is a horrific example, once again, of Israel in a long history, not only since this new extraordinarily far, far extremist right-wing government has taken power. This has been the case before in the willingness to attack Gaza, to attack civilians. And this was an attack on a residential apartment building. It was no surprise in the middle of the night that children were among the dead, that people were killed in their beds. And the fact that three of them are alleged to have been commanders of the Islamic Jihad organization does not give Israel the right to carry out this kind of extrajudicial killing, this kind of assault, this kind of murder by bomb, when there is knowledge that there will be civilian casualties. There is a desperate need to go back, first of all, to the ceasefire. Israel's violation of it was clear and unequivocal. This was a complete violation of international law, international human rights law, and international humanitarian law. As the occupying power, Israel has the obligation to protect the civilian population. That's across the board. It doesn't matter what other forces are negotiating with it, whether there are negotiations underway or not. That is Israel's obligation as the occupying power. Instead, we're seeing the expansion of an apartheid regime and one which is prepared to use violence at extraordinary levels without a moment's hesitation. And it's a complete violation, and the U.S. should stop its military support as a result.
Phyllis Bennis, we thank you so much for being with us, author and fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. When we come back, we go to Sudan, where the humanitarian crisis is worsening as fighting between the rival military factions enters its 25th day. Stay with us. Like the Cold by Snow Allegra, featuring Vince Staples. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Sudan, where fighting between rival military factions continues for a 25th day. On Monday, Sudan's military leader ruled out any peace settlement unless both warring parties agree to a lasting ceasefire. Representatives for the national military and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been holding talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. At least 700 people have been killed. Over 100,000 people have fled Sudan since the fighting broke out. This is a Khartoum resident who spoke to reporters from the border town of Wadi Halfa.
I need to take my insulin. Today is the third day that I did not take insulin. I have no money to buy insulin. I left all my money and my job in Khartoum. After the tax, I left everything behind and just came here. I don't own anything here, assuming that I would find a way to leave directly. There was nothing there that made me stay or wait. As soon as the tax happened, I left everything behind.
And this is Abdullah Osama, another Khartoum resident who fled the city.
We would wake up every morning to the sounds of bullets and missiles. We would walk and find corpses in the streets. Streets were closed, hospitals were closed, everything was closed. There were electricity and water cuts.
We're joined now by two guests. Khalid Mustafa Medani is an associate professor of political science and Islamic studies, chair of the African Studies program at McGill University in Montreal. He's from Sudan. And joining us from Khartoum is the Sudanese activist Maureen Al-Neil. We'd hoped to go to Maureen in Khartoum first, but we are having trouble with her line. There is so much trouble with power and electricity in this war-torn nation right now. Professor Medani, let's begin with you. Talk about what's happening right now. You have negotiations going on in Saudi Arabia, yet the forces on the ground, 100,000 people have fled the country, 700 are dead at least.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me on your show again. The crisis is incredibly severe and has increased in the course of the last 4 weeks or so. And not only is it about food insecurity at the moment, but famine potentially in the capital of Khartoum. And so in addition to the absence of electricity and clean drinking water, the lack of access to food, there is an unbelievable amount of loot of stores, of people's homes, the looting of factories, food factories. So the infrastructure of this city is particularly destroyed. And that's one of the biggest aspects of this humanitarian crisis, which is a really big problem. In addition to that, those volunteers, a youth activist, I think Ms. Neil will talk about a little bit more, are being actually threatened by both the paramilitary forces and the national army. In other words, those young people and networks in civil society that are trying to volunteer to actually provide medicine and food and supplies, utilizing social media and charitable work, so to speak, are the very people who are being detained and being intimidated and threatened. The Sudanese Doctors Union, which is doing all it can to provide medicine and provide health care and health services in the context of 70% of the hospitals in Khartoum that have been bombed, have also been threatened. And so there is a political aspect to it, a political crisis to it, but the humanitarian crisis is not only deep, it's now expanded throughout the country. The man you interviewed in Wadi Halfa in the north is just one of hundreds of thousands who are stuck at the border. It's not just about being stuck at the border, but the lack of access to food, medicine, even if you do have the finances, which of course most residents in Khartoum, for example, do not. The prices have quadrupled over the last weeks. And so the humanitarian crisis is really problematic, and the absence of the UN, kind of refugee agencies is really stark in the capital. There is some supplies that are coming from the World Food Program, but the absence and the lack of presence of the United Nations agency in the context of this complex humanitarian emergency is extremely disappointing.
Professor, let me go to Maureen Al-Neil. We just got Maureen Al-Neil back on, and while we're able to speak with her, Maureen, I'm so glad we could get in touch with you. I've been worried since we last spoke to you, not able to reach you. This has been going on now, we're in the 25th day. Can you describe what you're seeing on the ground and the level of threat to civilians, and if you see any possibility of these warring commanders stopping the fighting?
The humanitarian situation, Amy, in Khartoum has only gotten worse since we last spoke. So we're still suffering from shortages in food supply, power cuts. We have some areas in Khartoum that have had no electricity for over a week now, water cuts. And it's still very difficult and not safe to move around, which means many people are not able to go to hospitals or other centers that are providing medical care. And as has been said, 70% of medical services are down currently. And although the numbers are reporting that over 100,000 have fled to neighboring countries and 300,000 have been internally displaced, however, we have to remember that these are numbers are only small percentages and many have remained within Khartoum. Only those who can afford it, which are actually a small percentage of people, have left Khartoum. So now the remainder of the people who are here are people who have not been able to leave for financial reasons or other reasons. They are the people who have less access to international media, to even just internet or access to journalists or being able to get their story out there, basically. This is turning Khartoum into another war similar to the ones that have been raised by the Sudanese government on its people before. So it's becoming another ignorable war. When you have all the middle class and the upper middle class and all the foreigners have left Khartoum. This is what Khartoum residents are now facing. It's this fear that we are now going to be forgotten in this situation.
And how do you think people can be most helped by other African nations? I mean, talk about what's happening on the borders and also by the entire international community. Talk about the warring commanders, what they're demanding, and where the civilians fit into this picture.
Mm-hmm. Both parties, the Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces, do not seem to be genuine about their efforts to negotiate. Only yesterday, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has said to one media outlet that a peaceful solution is the only way to end the crisis, and has said in a statement by the Sudanese Armed Forces that they are not willing to consider any temporary ceasefire. Which implies that they're looking for a victory for the Sudanese armed forces. So it seems like both parties are not serious about their interest in creating a temporary ceasefire or maybe even safe passages so that the livelihood and the well-being of the people who are in these conflict areas can be taken care of while the conflict continues. It doesn't seem to be a priority for both parties. So I think the main effort that can be helpful to the residents of Sudan right now is to support the civilian efforts that are that have been providing aid for people in Khartoum and in other conflict-affected areas. It's only been popular efforts that have actually made an impact on the ground. NGOs, whether international or national, have not been able to reach because of the lack of safety. So it's the people who are also stuck in the conflict that have been able to provide things like ambulances and makeshift hospitals and even just getting food supplies and life-saving medication from one place to another. And during these trips, for example, only a few days ago, members of resistance committees that were running an ambulance were arrested by the Sudanese armed forces. So we're having to just face these risks just to be able to provide basic life needs.
And let me ask Khalid Mustafa Medani the question of whether this is becoming a kind of proxy war. You have the reports that the Wagner Group has been supplying Sudan's rapid support forces with missiles, and the Washington Post reporting Hemedti has close ties with Russia, whose mercenary Wagner Group reportedly supports his gold mining interests, while Burhan is backed by neighboring Egypt and the Arab world's most popular nation. Professor Medani.
Yes, absolutely. I think, quite frankly, the reason that the United States and Saudi Arabia, one of the main reasons that they're holding these what they call pre-negotiation talks is, number one, to feel out the two generals following the executive order that President Biden implemented in terms of the threat of sanctions or sanctioning these generals. But another had to do, and he stated in himself, and that is the spillover effect and the fact that other actors are going to use different domestic groups, in particular these two generals, as proxy actors. It's widely acknowledged that the Wagner Group, of course, has interest in gold. Russia has long had an interest in actually finding a base or establishing a base in the port of Sudan. And the United Arab Emirates, of course, has historically been very supportive financially and politically of Hemeti and Egypt of Burhan. Those, I think, are really important aspects of why these negotiations are taking place. I think there's absolutely no question that there is a great possibility of greater interference. And I think that's one of the reasons these talks are being held, the recognition that actors, particularly those unfriendly to the United States and Saudi Arabia, will actually intervene and complicate the situation, of course, and having a spillover effect throughout the region, which I think is extremely important. I do think, if you don't mind me saying, that there's a central problem with the negotiations. Number one, it is supposed to provide for humanitarian corridors after a ceasefire, but civil society and those, as Ms. Anil just mentioned, who are actually doing the humanitarian work, are completely excluded from these negotiations. And the danger here is to return to the previous history, where you basically have a compromise between two generals that basically reestablishes the very kind of tenuous balance of power that they had in the past. And most centrally and importantly, the repeated mistake, and I can't emphasize this enough, the repeated mistakes of these negotiations to exclude civil society actors, including non-governmental organizations and the resistance committees, the trade unions, the Sudan doctors unions, the very people who would be able to secure the implementation not only of a ceasefire in terms of service delivery, but also to make a potential negotiation durable in the future. My opinion is that actually betting on Hemeti and Burhan with respect to the international actors as sources of stability is completely incorrect. They have proven that they are not able to administer this country. And the only solution, and this is why the role of civil society here is so important in Sudan, the only solution, as civil society actors and many analysts, by the way, have insisted upon in the case of Sudan, that the only path towards stability is the establishment of a civilian democracy. That is not on the table, and Saudi Arabia and the United States have yet to actually put that on the table, including and also adding more stakeholders, more buy-ins into these negotiations. So once again, the same mistakes are being replayed. And this is, I think, what we really need to emphasize at this moment.
Khalid Mustafa Madani, a professor of political science and Islamic studies, chair of the African Studies Program at McGill University, Sudanese. Also, congratulations on getting your mother out to safety. Marine Al-Neil, all the very best to you. Sudanese activist who remains in Khartoum, as so many others do. We thank you both for being with us. Next up, protests continue after the death of Jordan Neely, longtime subway performer who'd become unhoused and was choked to death by a former Marine in a subway car last week. Stay with us. Lorenzo LaRocque performing in New York City subways. He's one of our next guests. I am Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Here in New York, 11 people were arrested at a protest Monday night demanding justice for Jordan Neely, 30-year-old unhoused black man choked to death in a subway car last week by another passenger. Jordan Neely was crying out that he was hungry and thirsty when he was fatally attacked on the train by a 24-year-old former Marine named Daniel Penny. Penny was interviewed by police detectives, but was released. He has not been arrested. Monday night's protest follows a similar demonstration Saturday when police arrested 13 people at a protest where they went onto the subway tracks and demanded Penny face charges. This is Juan Alberto Vasquez, an independent journalist who was in the subway car and filmed the fatal chokehold. He's speaking to NBC News.
The man got on the subway car and began to say a somewhat aggressive speech, saying that he was hungry, he was thirsty, and he didn't care about anything. He didn't care about going to jail, that he didn't care that he gets a big life sentence, and it doesn't matter if he died. If there was fear, the people who were bluish or who were there, where he separated everything, moved from their place. I stayed sitting in my place because it was a little further away. But obviously, those moments, well, one thinks fear, one thinks he may be armed.
The law firm representing Daniel Penny released a statement Friday expressing, quote, condolences to those close to Mr. Neely and adding, quote, Mr. Neely had a documented history of violent and erratic behavior, the apparent result of ongoing and untreated mental illness. When Mr. Neely began aggressively threatening Daniel Penny and the other passengers, Daniel, with the help of others, acted to protect themselves until help arrived. Daniel never intended to harm Mr. Neely and could not have foreseen his untimely death, the law firm said. Representatives for Jordan Neely's family responded Monday, calling the statement, quote, not an apology nor an expression of regret. It's a character assassination. They continued, quote, the truth is he knew nothing about Jordan's history when he intentionally wrapped his arms around Jordan's neck and squeezed and kept squeezing. He never attempted to help him at all. In short, his actions on the train and now his words show why he needs to be in prison, the family of Jordan Neely said. The killing of Jordan Neely comes as New York is facing a growing population of unhoused people who lack support they need, with many facing mental health crises. Officials say Jordan Neely had been arrested more than 40 times, including for multiple assaults, was on a list of unhoused people identified by aid workers as having dire needs. Before he fell on hard times, Jordan was well known to New Yorkers and tourists as a talented Michael Jackson impersonator who made a living in Times Square and on New York subways. For more, we're joined by two guests. Juwanza Williams is director of organizing at Vocal New York, and Lorenzo Larocque, who knew Jordan Neely for 20 years when they were both buskers in the New York City subway system. This is him playing his custom-made five-string plexiglass electric violin viola. We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Lorenzo, I want to begin with you. That was you playing the violin. You knew Jordan for 20 years as a fellow busker. Talk about him, as many New Yorkers and tourists knew him for years, this Michael Jackson impersonator, a member of the community of artists that we so often see in the subways.
Well, I worked with Jordan over a period of—I played down in the subways for 30 years. I worked with Jordan for about 20. And what we did was, he would do the noon to 3 o'clock shift. I'd get there around 2 for my 3 to 6 o'clock shift. And I could—you know, I spent years watching this man who was definitely a professional artist. He had a mastery of how he could work a crowd. If you could stop traffic in New York City with your talents, you're doing something positive. He was the most passive, beautifully a gentleman. And you know, this is consistently. I've never seen him aggressive. I've never seen him have a problem with the public. And what Jordan did, he gave freely to the city of New York and brought nothing but joy to this town for decades. And, you know, a misconception of street performers, we're out there giving it away. It's free. If you want to donate, that's fine. But, you know, we're doing our civic duty out there, keeping the peace. Just, we keep the peace better than cops, in the sense that in the 20 years that I've been out there and Jordan doing his thing, there was never any problem. Music calms the savage beast, while it also calms down New York City commuters. You know, Jordan was, God, how can I put it, not only the consummate professional, but he was he was Michael Jackson. You know, people can't see Michael in Times Square. He's an iconic figure. But Jordan embodied that persona.
Lorenzo, when you saw the video, which went viral, of Daniel Perry choking him to death, there were also two other passengers who were holding him down. And when people tried to help, they pushed them away. Your response?
I was witnessing a murder. That's what I said. It was painful and crushing. You know, here was a great artist being murdered in front of my eyes. And the fact that this gentleman is just walking the streets, it's a tragedy.
Juwanza Williams, there have been many people arrested in the last few days demanding the arrest of Penny, the ex-Marine who put him in a chokehold until he died. He hasn't been arrested. Many others have. Can you respond to the video, what you understand happened, and what you're calling for now?
Yeah, thanks again for having me, Amy. I deeply appreciate it. And as Lorenzo was saying, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the humanity of black people and what we're experiencing across these racist, violent United States. And I think that what happened is a catastrophe. And I think that we should honor the demands of the Neely family and have this person arrested. But really, I want to talk about, you know, one, for black people to avoid, continue watching the kinds of videos that create psychic harm for all of us, because these things affect our bodies and our mentalities. So I've avoided watching that video because I don't need to see another black person lynched again in this country. And so I avoided that video, and I don't want to watch that. So I can't speak to it specifically. But what I can say is that what has happened to Jordan Neely is reminds us that it's not, unfortunately, that his story is that unique. The fact is that since 2022, over 815 people experiencing homelessness in New York have died in public spaces. This is a structural phenomena, and I have to say that we have to hold also not just the murderer accountable. We have to hold Mayor Eric Adams and Governor Kathy Hochul for their continued right-wing, hyper-conservative, fear-mongering politics and politicking about our lives. Like, the fact that they flooded our subways with police to respond to people experiencing homelessness in the subway, and yet these same police officers were nowhere to be found when it was time to protect Jordan Neely from the violence of a white man, former Marine, strangling him to death. So what we need to see is not a mobilization of violence, but a mobilization of care in our subways. And our homelessness union at Vocal New York has been calling for that for multiple years. And so for me, I think that the state needs to do what it needs to do, what it always does, and, you know, use its carceral system to bring some kind of justice to this family. But I don't believe in the carceral system, so I have to say we want to build a loving and caring infrastructure in our city. So that means that Mayor Eric Adams, right now in the middle of this budget negotiation, needs to put our billions of dollars where they need to be in support of housing, in you know, wraparound services, safe haven beds. We need to see people rapidly rehouse out of shelters into secure housing, and sometimes that means housing vouchers, etc. And there's so many different things that need to happen. And I think that Governor Hochul, you know, just passed a state budget that didn't pass Daniel's law that would have automatically created mental health teams throughout the state so that they could actually respond to people who are actually in mental health crisis. And I'm not saying that Jordan Neely was, because everyone has deputized themselves to be like police in public, but they have also deputized themselves as psychologists. They are not psychologists. They are other commuters, and they do not have the right to diagnose anybody in the subway. Leave that to the professionals. And those professionals are not police officers.
I want to thank you both for being with us and ask you to stay with us, because we're going to do a post-show interview. We're going to post online at democracynow.org. Juwanza Williams, director of organizing at Vocal New York, and Lorenzo Larock, who knew Jordan Neely for 20 years, as they are both street performers on the street and in the New York City subway system. You can go to democracynow.org for that part two, as well as the part two of the conversation with the anti-death penalty activist Sister Helen Prejean, talking about the case of Richard Glossop and so much more. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.